All right. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Doug, and I'm a grateful believer in Jesus, and I'm a recovering sex addict. And today is episode 65 of our Castamonia Purity podcast. And I am here with Ryan Butterfield with the Regroup Counseling, which is located in Central Arkansas. And he is one of the co-founders of Regroup Counseling. But I asked him today if he would talk to us a little bit about family of origin. I know in my own personal recovery, in my own walk, beginning to explore what family of origin looks like is so important. So I hope that today we're able to have a conversation that kind of guides us into how do we do that with honor? How do we honor our father and mother and walk in a way that can change some patterns that we've developed? So welcome to the show, Ryan.
Yeah, great. I appreciate the opportunity.
Awesome. Well, first, if you want to introduce yourself and your work, and sure, then we'll get going from there.
Sure. Yeah, I'm Ryan Butterfield. And I just want to say at the beginning that I, too, am in recovery from sexual addiction. And so this isn't just theory for me. This is personal life. And I actually became a therapist. I'm a certified sexual addiction therapist. I have a master's in marriage and family therapy. Certified trauma therapist. Do a lot of EMDR work, brain spotting. These types of things to deal with trauma and addiction. But originally, I started into my master's in marriage and family therapy because I was an addict that needed help and went to therapy and couldn't really find it. And so where you go and the qualifications of the person and what they know and do they understand addiction, do they understand sexual addiction is important. So I just want to say off the bat that that my guess is the people that are listening to this podcast, I've been in their shoes, at least to some degree. Mm. Maybe not the exact same story, but to some degree, understand where they're at. And so I'm just grateful for the opportunity. And then another CSAT and a marriage and family therapist named Jim Gallion and I started the Regroup 6 years ago after we both had worked together in a residential treatment facility for 5 years. And so now we're just in private practice. We have a total of 8 therapists here that really serve all of Central Arkansas and kind of even the surrounding areas as people will drive in for more specialized treatment.
That's awesome. And thank you for that. And I think, you know, having that background obviously helps you connect with, you know, people you're serving in a deeper way to know, hey, I'm walking through this too. So I have some head knowledge, but I have some life knowledge as
sure.
well.
Sure.
Absolutely. So family of origin, you know, a lot of people hear that term and it gets thrown around in recovery. You know, if I sit in a recovery meeting, someone's going to share around the table that they're working on some family of origin work. But what does that term family of origin really mean?
Yeah. And so it's really the foundational things that happened in life, early on in life, that kind of set you up for later in life. And one of the biggest issues with doing family of origin work is that there are a couple different extremes that can happen. One of them would be the feeling like I'm blaming everything that's ever happened, all my choices, on my parents or on my family of origin, whether that may have been whatever caretakers you had. Sometimes it's grandparents that are taking care of you, that kind of thing. But so there's a feel of I don't want to blame everything. Or some people may say, well, you're just blaming your parents, kind of the traditional, they're in therapy, it must be their mom, as the joke, you know, kind of that goes around. So there's that kind of feeling. And then the other issue would be the opposite of that, which is I don't want to blame them, so I'm taking all the responsibility on myself, and I never look back at really some of those foundational things that set me up, or as Patrick Carnes talks about it, made me a vulnerable host for addiction later on in life. So I think it's important at the very beginning, anytime you're talking about family of origin work, to make sure, as you said before, how do I honor my family? At the same time of being able to say there are some things that may have happened that were not helpful. And my perspective on this is, generally speaking, I wouldn't say 100% of the time, but generally speaking, people are doing the best they can with whatever it is they've got. And so when we know the history of our family, if we go back a generation or two, we may see some patterns that have been passed down. And again, generally speaking, I think parents are doing the best they can. It just may be that they do not have the tools or resources or understanding or have done their own personal work to give us, when we were kids, what we really needed at that time. And so we can be angry about that. We can be mad about that. We can never talk to them again about that. That's options that some people take that don't seem to be real helpful in the long term. But my hope is that we can not be so black and white, which is, as you know, a typical kind of addictive mindset, the black and white thinking, but that we can hold both things at the same time together, which is they did the best they could, so I'm grateful for that, but yet I needed something else or something more or something different, and those are some of the hurts that may still be showing up today.
Yeah, and I think that's what's difficult for me, and I like that wording that you said was Patrick Kearns about the vulnerable host aspect. Because mm-hmm. When I think about that, if I were to say the home in which I was brought up made me a vulnerable host for addiction, how do I enter into that type of thinking without blaming them? And especially if I bring my wife into the conversation, how does she not blame them for creating me to be like this?
Right. Well, and so there's a quote, I wish I remember who said it, but it is, and it's from parenting, that is, you teach what you know, but you create who you are.
Hmm.
Okay, and so as anybody that's listening to this that is a parent knows that we're impacting our kids. There's no way around it. We are impacting them. The things that are going on inside of me that are not helpful, that I have not figured out. When I was in active addiction, I had one child at that time. I was not the parent that I am now in recovery. And so it does impact. And so I have to look back and take responsibility for my actions when I was a parent and how that's impacting my child and do something about it. So I do bear some responsibility. But ultimately, it will become my children's responsibility. It's my responsibility. To figure out what I am truly responsible for now. And a lot of times what addicts do, it's a little bit strange, is that we don't take any responsibility for our current behavior, and we place a lot of the blame and responsibility or accept responsibility for things that happened when we were kids, right? And so we'll look back at difficult times and we will believe messages about ourselves and take responsibility for things that really weren't ours, that then set us up later on to feel poorly about ourselves, that makes us not want to take responsibility later on in life.
So could you summarize family of origin then, like going back to that first question I asked you, as learning to figure out what to take responsibility for
absolutely.
Versus what to give over and say, okay, that was on them. That's the best they could. So it's really this idea of figuring out, where do I take responsibility now, and where do I take ownership, and where do I need to let that go and give that over to God or give that over to a higher power and say, this is not mine to carry.
Right. Absolutely. And the thing that you said that right there at the very end is an important phrase. It's not mine to carry. And so there's been a lot of people that have written and talked about the idea of carried shame, which is kind of a generational concept that would be the difficulty, the unhealth, the shame that my parents have experienced when they haven't dealt with it. They are then kind of passing it on to me, or they're operating out of that shame and out of that hurt in a way that is blaming. It could be kind of like gaslighting, like basically telling our kids, you're responsible for what I'm feeling. And so I'm telling you, you're responsible. So we are actually carrying the shame from our family of origin, that then it's playing out in our life like it's our own. And so absolutely one of the important things to do is to be able to go back and take appropriate responsibility throughout our entire life for what is truly ours, but also hand back over the responsibility for things that aren't ours. Dan Siegel talks about it, and I've kind of started with his concept and add a little bit to it, but an idea of what's called the integrated narrative. And so basically at this point, it would be able to go back and look to remember what we knew and what we felt and experienced as a kid from that kid's perspective that didn't understand everything that was going on, but it was very real at that moment, to have enough grace for us as children to be able to look back and say, this is what I felt and thought back then. But then also look at it from the adult perspective that we have now, and to go back and say, okay, now I have a little bit more understanding of what was going on. I have some emotions about what happened back then, and I can put all of that together to come to a better realization of kind of what I can do now going forward. Because I will guarantee you that there are messages that we received when we were kids that we still believe to be true today that are complete lies.
And that we don't even realize it.
And that we don't even realize
it. Right. So I know I've had a therapist in the past tell me that, you know, as a kid, you have to visualize yourself almost walking around with a clipboard. Mm-hmm. And you're walking around saying, oh, this is how we do things. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me write that down. Let me take notes. And now for the rest of my life, I'm going to follow the notes that I've taken in this clipboard. Absolutely. And so part of this work is going back and crossing things off that list, going, that's a lie. That's sure. not a belief that I need to have at all. And so being able to go through those and be real about those, and that's a difficult process.
It's very difficult because, again, if there was an actual clipboard, it would be handy. But it was just filling up in our framework of how we view ourselves, how we view relationship, how we view sex, how we view God, how we view everything. And we're coming with basically to these rules about how we interact in life. And they just happen every day, and we just absorb them very much in the same way that you and I are here speaking English to each other, right? And how did that come about? Well, we just heard people speaking English, and so we began to repeat what we heard. And it wasn't until later on in life that we learned how to read and write what we could already speak. And so this part of the recovery process is to go back and figure out what are the letters of this? What's the alphabet? How do I learn to read and write what I already know to be true or to believe to be true? Because we've just learned this framework, this like language, about relationship and about who I am. And so we have to go back and examine that. And some of those things are going to be lies.
So we develop patterns, but those patterns point back to rules that we've developed. And some are good and some are bad. And so we're trying to figure out which of those rules do we need to
hold on to and do we need to let go of? And, you know, I'll just throw this in here at this point as well, is that whatever you did to make it through childhood, it was generally speaking, pretty much what you needed to do. You had to figure out how to survive either a very dysfunctional, unhealthy household or just how to make it through the day anyway. And there were some things that were very useful back when we were a kid that we're still doing today that we need to disregard, do differently. Everybody kind of starts out with a pacifier, right, as a way to self-soothe. There aren't too many 40-year-old men walking around with a pacifier. Somewhere along the way, we say, that's no longer helpful or useful. I need to figure out a different way of doing this. But we don't often do that when it comes to bigger concepts like just relationship or sexuality. And so part of this, family of origin work, is to be able to go back and understand what was happening during that time period, what were the messages that I received about myself, sexuality, relationship, whatever, and then how did I respond to them now, or how did I respond to them then, how am I still responding to them now, what needs to change, and what doesn't, what can I keep?
And I've heard, you know, we were talking offline, and I've heard you talk about sometimes those messages, those false beliefs, are even enforced. I think you were given the example of, you know, a young girl who lost a dog, whose dog passed away, and she's crying about it, and the father, you know, doesn't want her to cry, so sends her inside the house, you know, breaks relationship for her to go inside the house where he doesn't have to be around her crying. So the next time something traumatic happens, she doesn't cry, and now she's praised for it. Fast forward now, she's 50 years old, she's running a company, she's CEO, and she's praised for the fact that she can go through anything without emotion. Is that ultimately a positive? Is that really what should have happened?
Right. And so what you're talking about here is attachment. And, there's all kinds of things written about attachment theory. But basically it is, do you feel safe in a relationship or not? It is your perception of whether relationship is safe. And so sexual addiction, it's been said numerous times that it's poorly named. It doesn't have a whole lot to do with sex. So really, it's talked about as an intimacy disorder or an attachment disorder. And so when you're talking about attachment, that's formulated early in childhood. Your initial experiences with the people that you're around the most are going to train you and teach you what's safe in a relationship, what to expect in a relationship, and what's okay to do or not do. Nobody sits down and says, we're going to have an attachment lesson today. You know, we don't do that.
Right.
It just plays out. And so, again, it's kind of the idea of carried shame, or that experience of the kind of unhealthier places in our parents, the attachment wounds that they have that they may be completely unaware of are then going to impact what they believe on how you should attach or what you should do. And then that's going to teach us, and then we're going to kind of formulate our best plan out of that. So what you were talking about a second ago with the young girl whose dog died would be kind of a situation, and I've heard that story numerous times over the years. I mean, that's a true story, not just made up, but true and very similar stories as well to that. But it is basically the experience that the daughter is needing attachment. She's needing security. She's needing comfort in that moment. Her dog has died, which is a very reasonable and understandable need, right? But for the dad in that scenario, he's so uncomfortable with his daughter's need for comfort. He doesn't know how to do it. He doesn't know how to handle the emotion. And so instead of dealing with that himself and trying to figure out how to do it, he distances himself away from her so that he can calm his own fear. So if you're going to keep crying, you need to go in the house. So then she goes in and he doesn't have to feel the discomfort of not having to comfort her anymore. But then the message is to the little girl who needs comfort from her dad is, if I express what I really need, which is comfort, it's going to lead to disconnect. So I have to keep what I need to myself and figure out a different way of handling this so that I can really take care of my dad so that I can still be connected to him. Mm. So I'll shut off the tears so I can stay outside and be with my dad because I need him, but I'm not really getting what I need. So they just call that a miscue. Well, as you can imagine, going through life with the different messages like that, which would be expressing sadness as weakness, you know, you can imagine a ton of different messages that can come that way.
Well, I can imagine junior high being just 2 years of miscues,
oh,
right?
Of course.
Yeah. Or, you know, yeah, just social upbringing too, not even just family, but you're getting miscues everywhere.
That's right. Okay. You're being taught how to protect yourself, not how to connect.
Mm.
That's junior high.
You're right.
You got to figure, you don't wear that, you don't say that, you don't listen to that, you don't, whatever it is, you have to learn how to protect yourself. So you're not learning how to connect, you're learning how to self-present. I'm going to show you the parts of me that you think are okay, which is another message and thing that happens in family of origin, so that later on in life, it's really hard for us to disclose who we are because we've had messages throughout all of life that says, if I really let people in and know who I really am, I'm going to be rejected. I'm going to be abandoned. And so I'm just going to present to you the parts of me that are okay.
For me, in my addiction, I never got past that. I mean, I was in junior high for 20 years.
Right.
Is that I only wanted people to see the good stuff.
Yeah.
But I never had an authentic relationship. I mean, even my wife and I didn't have a real relationship.
Sure. So you go back to Dr. Carnes's the internal belief system of the addict is it starts with basically at my core, I'm an unworthy person. That's the stress, right? Is that if I let somebody in and they get to fully and truly see me, they're going to say, you're not good enough. And so I don't want them to see me. So I have to hide who I really am, and I have to present only the parts of me that they're going to like. And so that, I mean, basically that's the concept of codependence as well. And so it's a very important part of the addict's belief system. In fact, it's often said that it is the core addiction. It's the first addiction. Because if you think about it, when you're a kid, you have no real concept of who you are. You have no clue. If your dad says you're stupid, you believe him because you're five. And you have no way to say, you know, dad's having a really bad day. He's struggling at work. He can't pay the bills. and I left my Hot Wheels out, and he stepped on it and hurt his foot. But when he said I'm stupid and that I'm no good or whatever, it's because of all the stuff going on with him, not me. No,
right.
We just believe it's me, right? And so the external world begins to come in and develop our belief system about who we are, about how we're treated. When abuse, it's the vulnerable host concept. When abuse shows up, the messages that are sent, that you're just, if it's sexual abuse, that you're designed for sex, this is what you're good for, the other people's needs and wants are more important than your own safety. I mean, there's all kinds of messages that are coming from the outside world that are telling us about who we are. But they're all lies. They're not true. But we're too young to know. And so we just accept them as truth. And so then we're continuing to grow up. And if the outside world gets to determine what we believe about ourselves, then holy cow, we better be really careful about what we share with the outside world, right? And so the kind of the basic idea here of codependence is that I'm paying more attention to the external stimulus out here than the internal. So if somebody says I'm stupid, it weighs more than if inside I say, no, I'm smart. So what they think seems to have more weight than what I think. And so when you think about addiction, it really is an escape from what we believe and feel about ourselves. We want to feel something different. We don't like the way that we feel. We don't like the way that we think about ourselves. Whether it's just stress is too much or life is too hard or whatever it is, something is happening inside of me that I do not know how to handle or take care of. And so I'm looking for an outside source to come in and make me feel differently. It could be cocaine. It could be pornography. It could be an affair partner. It could be you name it. But it's an outside source that's going to be come in. So I become dependent on something external to try to change what I feel internally. And the first experiences that we have with that is other people. So I need my mom to come in and take care of me. I need my dad to come in. Well, of course, we're an infant. We have to have those kind of experiences. But as we get older, when the messages have been that you have to be perfect in order to be loved, if you make a mistake, it's going to be thrown in your face. Whatever those negative messages are, if I mess up at school, I'm going to be mocked and made fun of, or whatever it may be, then I've got to figure out how to be perfect, how to at least look perfect, or how to present to the world that I'm perfect, all the while believing and knowing something else to be true that becomes so painful, can't share with anybody else. I have to go to addiction to cover it up and to mask it.
And to soothe it. So one of the joys, I would say now to a listener, of being on a podcast is the fact that you can pause this and go back and listen to that again. There were some pretty profound statements that Ryan just made. Maybe you need to pause it and think about in your own life, what are those things? And so do that, you know, reflect on that, meditate on it, pray on that, and start to maybe listen to this again and really put that in the framework of your life and in your walk. I know for me, in my addiction, when I look back, I see that codependency developing. I can start to see my family of origin, where it came from, and how I wanted attachment with my parents. And what I got was me trying way too hard to earn it and to show them and to become a life of performance so I could earn it. And when I performed and did well at something, you got their attention, so I better keep performing. And so it created this codependency mindset within myself. But how do I go back and give that kid some grace? How do I go back and say, all right, he's not stupid. Mm-hmm. He's a kid.
Yes.
Like, it's easy for me, and it shouldn't be, but it's easy for me to look back at myself when I was 14 and say, oh, I should have known better.
Sure.
Why didn't I just blah, blah, blah?
Absolutely. And so earlier when I said that a typical kind of person struggling with addiction is not taking responsibility for their current behavior, but taking too much responsibility for the past. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You go back to 14 or to 10 or, I mean, all the way down 5, 4, I mean, young, and say, I should have known better. We're taking responsibility for things that we did not have the capacity to take responsibility for. So we have to go back and figure that out. And so there's a couple ways to do that. One is to figure out, what do you say about yourself when the lights are out, you lay your head down on the pillow at night, and you beat yourself up? And everybody has had that kind of experience before. What are the negative things that you say about yourself? I'm not good enough. that is kind of the all-encompassing one that a lot of people can resonate with. But there's usually nuances to that. So I usually say, you're not good enough because why? What is it that makes you not good enough? Well, because I don't have enough money, or because I'm not smart enough. I'm not attractive. I'm not whatever. Brene Brown calls that the scarcity kind of model, that there's not enough of something. I'm missing out on something. And so when you look at how do I, or what are the beliefs I have about myself currently, you are not the first person that told you that. I will promise you. You are repeating the messages that you have heard before. Before you ever believed them to be true, somebody else was telling you that. And you heard it often enough that you accepted it as truth. And it became, a lot of times, just like it's DNA. Like, I'm here, I've got blue eyes, I've got brown hair, and I'm 5'9 and 3/4". And to me, the 3/4 is a big deal, right? And so because I'm not enough, I've got to be taller, that kind of thing. And if I believe that I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not attractive enough, it's like it's sometimes at the same level that I have blue eyes. What am I going to do? How am I going to change my eye color? How tall? I mean, I have to stand up as straight as I can to try to get to 5'10". You know, it's like I'm 5'9 and 3/4". That's it. And if I'm not good enough, that's just it. And it feels that way because the messages that we've received a lot of times from family of origin or just that time period in life, it's not always just the parents. We have so many influences. And so it's not just family of origin work. It's childhood work. But we've felt this way for so long, and a lot of times we don't remember the initial comments or situations because we were so young when they originally happened. It just feels like it's just always been this way. I've just never been good enough.
Yeah, it can just completely just feel like who you are. And I heard you have kind of an interesting homework assignment for some people that you work with to start to explore this concept.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a movie, The Kid. It's a Disney movie. It's got Bruce Willis in it. It's older. But it's a great inner child work, and I don't want to give the whole thing away, but it's you know, obvious, even in the title, that Bruce Willis is interacting with the younger version of himself, and he's able to kind of go back in time and see some of the interactions that happened when he was younger that have impacted his life in a way that has kind of filtered him and directed him to who he is, how he's behaving, what he believes about relationship, what he believes about himself. It's impacted his profession. It's impacted relationship with family. He's single. He's kind of a jerk. He even has some somatic responses that were based on these childhood kind of things. And really, what you're able to see is how Bruce Willis, as the adult, is able to see some of the lies that he believed when he was a kid. And he talks to himself, the kid, and comforts him. Mm. And it's a very similar process that we ask for you to do now. These messages that you have inside your own head, can you go back and pick out some of the major kind of touchstone events that happen where maybe your dad never came to any of your sporting events? And so there was a message that work is more important than me, you know, kind of a generic one. Can you go back and talk to that child and be able to say, I understand this was the message that you got, but that really was not the truth of the matter. And it may be dad had all kinds of issues he needed to work on. It had nothing to do with you. Or it may be the bills were so overwhelming that he was doing everything that he could and literally could not make it there. But he never explained that to you because he was so ashamed of not being able to pay the bills.
There's so many nuances, that some of which we'll never know. And that's sort of the concept of I've heard of with chair therapy, where you talk to your 8-year-old, 12-year-old, 10-year-old self to be able to comfort them, which sounds, you know, odd sometimes. And maybe some listeners just turned off the podcast and said, that's too far out there for me.
Right.
But how do you talk to that kid and give them the grace and say, hey, you were a kid, I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah.
And how important is that in our development and recovery?
It's very important. And I would say this, first of all, you've got to figure out if you know how to comfort anybody. Because when we were never comforted, then sometimes we've got no clue. Just like in the story that the girl with the dog that died, the dad didn't know how to comfort. So if he was a sex addict and we said, go back and take care of your inner child, he would be, I can't even comfort my own daughter. I don't know how to do that. And so it's modeled for us, usually in childhood, but you can learn these things. You can learn how to comfort. So first you have to figure out, are you comfortable with discomfort? Can you stay in the middle of the discomfort? And you practice, how can I comfort my own child? How can I do that with my friends, with my family? And you work through that. But then ultimately, you do it the same way as a good parent would do for their own child. You would have the same conversations. Sometimes you can do it in letter writing back and forth. But you just think of it kind of like this, like the inner child is still a living part of you that's just part of who you are. Hmm. And so I think we can all understand the concept that somebody may say something and it triggers a hurt from the past, and we kind of react out of that wound. And a lot of times we'll react in the way that when that original wound happened, how we would have reacted. So if I'm 8 years old and somebody did something really mean to me, how does an 8-year old respond? Well, I'm 43, and if somebody does the same thing, it triggers the same wound. If I kind of lose myself in that moment, I'm acting like an 8-year old, right? And so in the same way, those parts of us are still kind of alive and active. And so we go back in and we have a conversation with that inner child. And you reference the empty chair work. You imagine them sitting there with you. You get out a picture from when you were younger, and you imagine yourself at that age. You kind of talk through it. And I would also say this, the majority of this is something to do in therapy with a trained therapist, because a lot of times it's not just a single message that we're hearing. There may be abuse, there may be trauma, there may be other things that are going on that are getting triggered and brought up. Mm-hmm. And so although some things would be fine to be able to do on your own, I'm not saying don't try this at home, but just be wise about that.
Right.
And talk to your therapist about it. But ultimately, the idea with the family of origin work is to be able to go back to understand the messages that you had at that time, how it developed into your belief system about yourself, about relationship, which would be don't talk to others, don't share your emotion, these kinds of messages. See what those are and see what remains true and helpful today, and then look back and think, okay, maybe there are some of these things that I need to disregard or do away with.
And I think that's a great summation of what we've talked about and some things to do. And obviously in a 30-minute conversation, we can't do that. Sure. It's definitely on my heart to also say for those that are listening, this doesn't mean that we get a free pass to say, well, look, this is how I was raised. It's what my kids created. Yes. It's what my parents created. It's a monster that they made. So I get a free pass. So, right. We definitely still have ownership for how we handled it as adults when we could take that responsibility.
Absolutely. And no matter what the past is, it is your responsibility now. You're the only person that can do anything about it. You're the only person. So even if it's everybody else's fault, let's just say that for a second, it's not true, but even if it's everybody else's fault, you're still the one that's responsible for where you go from here. So if you want life to be better, if you want life to be different, you're the one that has to take the action to make it different. Mm. So to go back to what I was saying before, people in the middle of addiction as adults don't take responsibility for what they're currently doing, and they take too much responsibility from the past. And so we really have got to flip-flop that. We've got to take complete responsibility for where we're at currently and go back and figure out what things do I really take responsibility for from the past, and what things do I need to hand back over and say, this part wasn't me. I'm no longer going to hold myself responsible or feel the shame of something that happened to me when I was 8 years old, for example.
Right. I think that's really wise. And so hopefully for those listeners that are out there, you're getting some ideas of some things that you can do. So here in our last minute or so, do you have any final words for somebody that's just trying to figure all this out, or any resources if they want to dive in a little deeper into some of these concepts? What might you share with some people like that?
Sure. One, I would just say anything by Pia Melody. I'm a big fan of hers, and she does a lot of writing, things about codependency and how it's rooted in childhood. And again, looking at codependency is kind of the root of addiction coming out of that, or part of the root. And so anything by her. But there's another one, because I think attachment is just a big deal. And so there's a lot of people in recovery that are parents as well. And they're looking back and they're saying, man, what? How do I, if I didn't attach well when I was a kid, I'm not doing that great as a parent. a book called Raising a Secure Child by Kent Hoffman. A couple other authors in there as well. But it's just excellent to help understand not just what I need to do now as a parent, but also perhaps maybe some of the things that I was lacking when I was a child, to understand that better, that can also help us change what's going on today. So a couple of little, you know, just broad resources there. Most everybody, there's tons of books specifically about sexual addiction, but going back and reading more about attachment, understanding attachment, and those kind of family of origin kind of concepts will be huge to help you in your recovery today. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for pointing in those directions. And for those listeners that are out there that you're, I don't know what to do. I don't know the next turn. Well, you can always email us at puritypodcast@castamonia.org. We may not know either, but we'll find somebody who does, and we'll get back to you with what resources we think might help. You know, we're all in this together trying to figure it out. So, you know, feel free to check us out on the website or email us and let us know that, you know, hey, this is what I need. This is what I'm seeing. If you have needs for our future episodes, also email us, let us know, puritypodcast@castamonia.org. And I just appreciate you listening and your heart in wanting something better for yourself. And just remember, as you're walking on this road of recovery, you are not walking alone.